Construction meets the world's most popular board game in new Monopoly Construction Edition. Amass or possibly lose great fortunes. Every space on the board is packed with both iconic construction brands and incredible infrastructure projects in this new exciting edition of Monopoly. You'll need to make smart decisions to come out on top. Have you got what it takes to succeed in the world of construction? Search Construction Monopoly to order now.
Hello, it's Wednesday, the 27th of January, 2021, and you're listening to Reconstruction, the weekly podcast from the Construction Index. I'm David Taylor, editor of the Construction Index magazine, and with me, via the magic of Zoom, is our online news editor, Phil Bishop. Morning, Phil.
Morning, David. How are we doing?
Okay. Rather damp, though, today. We've got that sort of mist that you only really get in the West Country. Sort of very proactive mist. It gets in everywhere, you know.
Did you have the snow last week?
Oh, no. We had a light dusting, but you had a bit more, I think, didn't you, over there in Kent?
I don't know whether anywhere in Kent had it, but in my particular village, we had absolutely none.
Oh, really?
And friends from about half an hour away were sending us photos of their garden with 6 inches of snow and their puppy frolicking in it and enjoying it. And we thought, well, it's going to be coming here in a minute, and it never came.
Wow, we've got a microclimate there.
I think we do.
Anyway, what's been happening in the world of construction over the last week? There's been quite a lot of product news, hasn't there, to do with building products, testing and failure and all the rest of it.
We talked a little bit about building products and so on last week,
yeah.
But I think the most interesting thing, and it's a public service announcement I think we can put out here and encourage people to partake in a consultation that starts on the 1st of February, which is on Monday, 1st of February, and runs for 2 months, all about a proposed code of practice for construction product information. This is another thing that comes out of the Grenfell Tower fallout. It was suggested that an awful lot of people in the industry were specifying and using products because either they misunderstood or had a lack of understanding or made assumptions they shouldn't have made about the appropriateness of certain products, in that case for the recladding, the cladding refurbishment of the Grenfell Tower, which was evidently not fit for purpose. And the Construction Products Association set up something called a marketing integrity group, which to some people might sound like an oxymoron up there with police intelligence. And I don't know if you've seen the famous Bill Hicks routine about the evils of marketing and marketing people. I think it's too easy and too cynical to mock marketing as an industry, but it's fun to do anyway, but we shouldn't do it. They do serve a purpose, I suppose. But anyway, they've realised basically that, and they say themselves, that the reputation of construction product marketeers has been tarnished, at the least.
Yeah, that's putting it mildly.
If not totally and utterly trashed, yes, by the whole fallout of Grenfell Tower product specification and usage and so on. But to their great credit, this marketing integrity group under the auspices of the Construction Product Association has been working hard for the past couple of years and has produced what is now a 24-page document setting out proposals for a new way, a new code for anyone who is a manufacturer of either of a single product or where products come together to form a second product, if you like, in a system. Their rules and regulations, if they sign up to this code, they undertake to essentially be honest and transparent. It's not hugely dissimilar from the advertising standards code of practice, but it goes much further than that, even to the extent that you should never be too, on their website, you should never be two clicks away from a phone number or an email address where you can get more information. It's detailed, it's thorough, and I am sure there's some devil in the detail that people might want to flag up and get in touch with the authors and say, have you thought about this? I'm sure you haven't. But on the whole, I think it's more than a starting point. It looks close to a finished code to me. I dare say the consultation. I hope the consultation yields some revision.
Are they asking for consultation with everybody in the supply chain or just from the manufacturers?
Yes, contractors, people who use construction products, people who specify them, people who make them, everyone.
Right.
And I think it's important that people do have a good old chew on this document. And do provide some, even if it's just to say, well done, people, you know, good work. Because I think people who do good work ought to be told more often that they're doing good work.
There's a website, isn't there, that you can visit to...
Building Safely. Not Building Safety, but buildingsafely.co.uk. wubble.buildingsafely.co.uk. And as I say, a consultation runs for 2 months, 1st of February to the end of March.
Yeah.
Have you had a chance to look at it? What any immediate reactions from you?
I've only skimmed it. There are 11 clauses or sort of main sort of points, aren't there, in here? Summary of it, 11 points, which all seem fairly straightforward and common sense to me, in fact. There's nothing in there that I noticed that made me sit up and think, well, you know, that's asking rather a lot. It all seemed to be asking manufacturers to do the sort of thing that they really ought to be doing anyway. Was there anything in there which you noticed and thought maybe was a bit of a step beyond? Or
No, not at all. I was interested in the idea that, because we all know websites, I'm not talking specifically about the construction industry, but any you know, consumer service where you're trying to get help and there's no phone number. If there is a phone number, it says go to our website, and the website doesn't. You know, there might be a form you can fill in, but you actually want a much more precise email address, don't you, that, rather than just fill in a form.
And I think, I think that's a real step forward. I think that's a really good idea. There's one thing I didn't quite understand. It was the second clause. The first one was that a manufacturer must have in place a documented sign-off process for creating product information, which I think is fairly self-evident.
Yeah, with a named individual. So if there's something wrong, it's their fault.
And
it's going to be pinned on someone.
The second one I wasn't quite sure about, which was that a manufacturer must have in place a formal version control process for all product information. I'm not quite sure what a version control process is. Is it if it gets updated or revised?
Yes.
Yeah.
When it gets revised, you can say, okay, this is the 2021 or January 2021 version.
Yeah.
And so you know what you're not out of date, or there's not a later version.
Yeah, that's good. Well, number three, I was very pleased to read this. Number three was that you should not use misleading or ambiguous wording, phrasing or imagery, and embrace the use of plain English to ensure accurate representation of product information and performance claims. That'll be a first if the marketing industry embraces that one. they're given to hyperbole, aren't they?
It does say you can use jargon so long as that it's you... can justify the fact that this is everyday, well-understood industry jargon. It's not too obscure.
Well, if it's industry jargon that is sort of like shorthand that people in the know would understand, that's fine. It's when people start to use woolly phrases, which sound good but don't actually mean much, that things start to fall apart, I think. I think that the CPA should be congratulated for this. They're doing what they should do, and I think that if people fall in line with this, it can only be a good thing, I think.
But it goes beyond saying your product information must include what it is, what it can do and what it can't do, and the documentation that certifies, I want to say prove, but certification doesn't prove anything, and we'll come on to that in a minute, I think. But what you're certified to do, what you've been tested to do, and what you've not been tested to do. So it's not only just the ingredients and the performance of specification, but it's also things like the recycling, the after use, how to dispose of it after use, and the packaging, and even beyond that, the handling of it, whether it's manual handling or whether you need to use special lifting equipment, and so on and so forth, and what these should be, and the installation process. So it's not just the application, the specification of the product; it's the full use and recycling, the waste disposal, handling. That there's a lot there. It's all the information that you need to know as an end user or a specifier.
Yeah, yeah. Well, as you said earlier, this is not a moment too soon, because the construction products industry has come in for a lot of criticism following Grenfell Tower. And, you know, at the centre of this is the, you know, the ACM cladding, the aluminium composite cladding system, which was obviously responsible for the terrible spread of fire over Grenfell Tower. And, well, we needn't go into all the toings and froings about that. It's still very much under review. So, you know, I think that sort of alerted people to the fact that there is a problem, a sort of a systemic problem, really, in the industry with the description, the marketing, even the testing and the certification of building products. And in fact, I noticed last week there was a story on, which you posted on the website, saying that there are still 45 tower blocks in the UK which have been identified as having, you know, they're above the 18, is it 18 metre height?
18 metre height is the threshold.
Yeah, and they've still got this ACM cladding on them, and they haven't even started to remove it, which is terrible for the people who live in these buildings.
Oh, so, I mean, the story, aside from the construction industry story of getting these the cladding taken off these buildings and either something else or some other system put on in place, is the whole story of all these poor people with leasehold mortgages who can't sell their flats, can't move, they're stuck.
Being faced with massive bills which they can't possibly meet in order to get this cladding removed from the building and something which isn't going to kill them put back on it. When you hear these people's stories, it just beggars belief, because they're totally victims or waiting to be victims, because there they are living in these flats in buildings which are potential Grenfell towers, and they're being said, well, you can get out of this sticky situation by giving us umpteen £1,000 in order to take the cladding off and put something else on.
Even if you could afford that, you need everyone else in the building to be in a position to afford it, which is even harder. I mean, it's a nightmare.
So fit for purpose is the phrase that springs to mind when you're talking about cladding in post-Grenfell times. And determining what is actually fit for purpose isn't quite as straightforward as you might think, is it, Phil?
Go on, then.
You ran a story, didn't you, recently? I think you should do this one, actually, because you're running the story about the BBA, this testing body.
What Grenfell has taught us, of course, is, I mean, you've mentioned this yourself before, about the whole concept of what's fit for purpose and what fit for purpose means. And one of the things which the Marketing Integrity Group doesn't, their code for construction product information doesn't tackle, and this might be something that might come up in consultation, is the whole role of the British Board of Agrimont.
Yeah.
Now, I had an interesting conversation with a construction product manufacturer last week, and this is a guy at the technical science and engineering end rather than the marketing end. The distinction being, of course, that the scientists and engineers will tell you that you're buying a motor car, and the marketers will tell that you're buying a dream machine. And so, a man who's more interested in what it does and what it is, he was telling me about the problems, as he sees it, or the shortcomings, as he sees it, of the British Board of Agrimont, BBA, for anyone who's not familiar with it as an organisation. It's been around for 50 years or so. It's sort of started off as a government body. It's an industry-owned body. And it is the organisation which provides certificates of conformity for building products. And it is virtually impossible, it seems, to sell a product. Might not be the case of a bag of sand or a clay brick, I'm not so sure, but anything made of plastic or anything with any sort of science in it, I suppose, to sell a building product which has not got a BBA stamp on, say, you know, fit for purpose. We, the independent gods, have signed this off. We approve.
We should point out, of course, that they don't set the standards. I mean,
no, British standard or ISO, there are the standards which are there. Yeah, they're a third party testing house and certification body that say you've met the standards, we agree. And I hadn't realised that there are no competitors. There is no other organisation. We talked before that you can go to several organisations to have your ISO 9001 processes certified. Mm-hmm. Lloyd's compete with DNV and other people for these sort of other sort of certification. But in building products, BBA is apparently a monopoly.
Yeah.
And it's a benign, benevolent one. It doesn't make a profit. All its profits are turned back into the organisation itself, to its running. In fact, it quite literally doesn't make a profit, or it doesn't in its latest accounts. I had a look at its annual report most recent accounts to June 2019, and it turned over £11 million, which is, so it's not a huge organisation. I think something like 150-odd employees.
Yeah.
Most of those, two-thirds of those are engineering, scientific, test, audit and inspection people. And I was surprised at how few, to my imagination, how few certificate or valid BBA certificates are out there. 1,300.
Now you think, is that all?
If you go into your local B&Q and think of all the products on the shelves and all the products which aren't on the shelves which are used on building projects, mm-hmm. I would have thought there would be thousands and thousands,
yeah.
But certainly single number of thousands of. Well, I suppose 1,300 is single number of thousands, but I would have thought there'd be more than 1,300 building products out there.
But I suppose that's because, as you pointed out just now, it tends to be sort of highly manufactured products and systems, like drainage systems and ventilation systems. You wouldn't get nails, screws and sawn timber with BBA certificate, I wouldn't have thought.
You probably ought to. Many's the screw that I've been cursing, where you put it into the wall and the head comes off just when it's in, and then you're stuck with a screw with no head stuck in your wall that you can't get out.
Yeah, maybe they should turn their attention to that.
My own fault. I'll probably buy the cheapest ones. Anyway, caveat emptor doesn't hold in all of this. We need more. We need better than caveat emptor. We need badges and certificates to guide us. So the BBA, it's fallen victim to the reputational damage of the whole product universe, mm-hmm. On the back of Grenfell Tower, along with everyone else. It hasn't escaped from the fallout, and a new chief executive took over in January 2020, last year. So he's only been in post for a year. A guy called Hardy Giesler. Forgive me, Hardy, if I'm pronouncing your name incorrectly, your surname. I'm sure I've got Hardy right. And he's an industry insider. He's a former director of Tarmac Building Products, former MD of Tarmac Top Block. And his predecessor was a former Labour MP. So to my mind, it's a step in a very positive direction, getting someone who's from the building products industry. Other people might say it's a lack of independence, that you want an independent outsider, but I think we need someone who's got some understanding of industry requirements and attitudes. And the BBA does have the chap I was talking to the other day was telling me that it has a shoddy reputation, the BBA, within his particular sector of the building products industry. He says their lack of knowledge and understanding of the required performance of the products is quite mind-boggling, he says, which is in stark contrast to the BBA website will tell you that all their testers and inspectors are renowned industry experts.
And
it may well be that they are, and they don't have enough time, and they're firefighting, and they haven't got time to do the job properly. So it may not be the competence of the people, it may be the systems and the way the organisation has been mm-hmm. run in the past. But the perception of this engineer I was talking to from a building products firm is that they're incompetent.
Yeah, well, I have heard, I mean, over many, many years, when I've occasionally spoken to product manufacturers, I have often heard grumbling about the BBA, because you have to keep paying them money to get your certificate updated and renewed and the testing done and all the rest of it. And a lot of people say that actually the certificate isn't worth the paper it's printed on. Now, I haven't really looked into this, so I don't know whether or not their claims are justified at all. But there does seem to be widespread discontent about the whole process. And I suppose it doesn't help that it is apparently a de facto monopoly and that this is a third-party organisation. It's not an official organisation. You shouldn't have to have a BBA certificate, but it has become something that you can't do without. If you want to product, you want to market your product in the industry, you need the BBA certificate to go along with it.
Well, that's exactly what my man says. He says that the construction industry, the users love it. I mean, they love the existence of a BBA certificate. They find it incredibly reassuring. And that if I mean, this guy I was talking to, he spent somewhere between $250,000 and $500,000 on the BBA over the past 10 years. It's a substantial outgoing for his business.
Yeah.
And if he decided not to bother with those certificates and just to rely on his company's own good name and reputation, even with that, he reckons he'd see an 80% drop off in sales.
Yes.
He absolutely needs that certificate. But the problem is he sees it, is it's just he's being held over a barrel by BBA. I mean, he thinks it's a racket. Now, I don't see it like that, I've got to say, because the BBA is not a private organization like some of these plant operator testing organizations where someone individual is able to buy a yacht at the end of the day. I don't think anyone at BBA is buying a yacht out of this. But to me, putting together the little bit of investigation I've done into BBA, and I have got an interview request in to, I've asked Hardy Giesler for an interview to talk to him about all of this, because I think now he's the new man in the saddle and he knows what's going on.
Yeah.
I'm sure he's going to have lots of interesting stuff to say about how he's going to change things and what he's doing. But the annual report I looked at, the year to June 2019 annual report, it says, and here's a telling sentence, clients pay for certification, which is a potential threat to impartiality. So it is critical that our product approval certification services are highly professional, transparent and impartial. Now, those are the three words I think are key here. Professional, transparent and impartial. I believe BBA is impartial. I believe that. There's no suggestion of anything crooked going on. Professional, I have no position to doubt their professionalism. What is patently clear is where they're failing is on transparency. That's the nub of the issue. Now, going back to my conversation with my chap, he has his own labs and he tests his products, puts them through lab testing, and he puts competitor products. He makes his business get hold of competitor products and puts competing products through the labs as well to see how they perform. And he knows that some of his competitors are getting BBA certificates when, according to his tests, they don't meet the standard. They fail the tests.
That is a problem.
And he has said to BBA, after they've, you know, had, looking at his application for a new product certification, they've had it for 18 months, and said, yep, here's your badge. Here's your Blue Peter badge that I talked about last week. And he says, great, thank you. Can I see your test results to make sure that, you know, how they correspond with mine? Can I see your paperwork? Can you show me your workings out? No. They will never present him with their workings out. They will never show how they reach the conclusions that they reached.
Well, that doesn't inspire confidence, does it?
He doesn't believe. He tells me that they have no labs at all at the BBA. They just simply rent offices and they just follow the paper trail. BBA says on its website it has extensive test facilities.
Yes.
So which of those is true, I don't know. Maybe BBA has access to extensive test facilities. How much it uses them, I don't know.
They're based near Watford, aren't they?
But they've got people all around the country. But the
head
office,
maybe they just troll down to the BRE and use their labs.
I think there's a close relationship between BBA and BRE. I think but even if the BBA does have test facilities, the fact that this man who's been working, you know, has had a close financial relationship, paying them, you know, 300 and something thousand pounds over the past 10 years, doesn't believe they have, that suggests a lack of transparency, a lack of getting their message across. In addition to that, every year someone from the BBA comes in and does an audit, and my man says, oh, well, do you want to have a look at our lab and see our product tests and check our products? No, thank you. Just want to see the paperwork. And it's just like an ISO 9001. It's just like a QA. Have you done the processes? It's not does your product work? It's, have you jumped through the right hoops that our systems say you should jump through? And the feeling of my, the man I was talking to, is that it's not good enough. They they need to be seen to be testing products and showing this is how we've tested and this is why it's failed and this is why it's passed.
Yes.
I'd be interested to see how many failures there are of BBA. I haven't found any you know, what the pass rate is or whether everyone passes. I don't know that one. It might be worth BBA shouting about that number occasionally to make it clear that it's not easy to get a BBA certificate and therefore it means something.
Yes, that would be good. I mean, it does rather raise a question of, do we actually need an organisation like the BBA? Because, you know, we have the British standards, the European standards, and all the other standards which these products need to conform to. And presumably they need to be tested in order to prove that they are marketable and fit for purpose.
No, but the British standard, you the manufacturer, I can start making whatever, a tape recorder, put it on the market and say it meets the whatever the BS British standard is for tape recorders. Do we still have tape recorders? Let me use a more modern example.
It's all digital now.
I can make a space hopper and say it meets the British standard for space hopper. That's probably a brand new proprietary term. Okay, I can think of a really new product.
Yes,
and
okay.
As long as it meets the British standard, I say it meets the British standard, it meets the standard. It's up to BBA, as I understand it, to say, yes, it does. So you do need, I think, third-party, independent badge from a respected, credible organisation that's got the confidence of the industry to prove that manufacturers aren't pulling the wool over your eyes.
Okay, but in outside of the construction products industry, there are other products like space hoppers and tape recorders.
Children's toys is what I was alluding to. I mean, children's toys is a classic thing.
But do other sectors of the manufacturing industry have equivalent bodies to BBA? I mean, loads of products have to carry a kite mark, don't they, in order to, or it used to be a CE mark, in order to demonstrate conformity to the appropriate standard. That goes for building products as well, doesn't it?
Do you know what? I can't believe that children's toys are allowed to self-certify. If you think that the potential hazard, I don't know. I'm going to have to look into that, carrying a BS kite mark or an ISO kite mark, what you have to do.
Yeah. But I just wonder.
But there's an awful lot of self-certification out in the world, and we take their word for it. And you only come a cropper if it finds out after the event that you are lying, kind of thing. So the insurance company, maybe it's up to the insurance companies to run it all. And a lot of insurance companies are pretty tight on making sure that companies' products are, their testing is watertight. But I think the BBA has the support of contractors and end users by and large. I haven't heard huge criticism from them, but then they're not paying its bills. They're not its customers. They're just its beneficiaries. But I want to quote my man again, the manufacturer, building products manufacturer. He said, I'm going to quote you here, there's a very strong dislike of BBA. No one thinks the certificates are worth anything, but no one will openly discuss it because if you don't get your BB certificate, your business will go somewhere else. There's a fear that if you speak out, you might get your certificates frozen or removed. So the manufacturers seem to be actually scared of scared of the power of the BBA.
Yes.
The BBA holds over them. Well, that's not necessarily a bad thing. I think you know, if you think that the BBA, if you're a manufacturer and you think that the BBA is toothless and has no authority, that way there are dangers there too.
But you can see why customers would value the BBA, because you know, if they're looking for a certain type of product, let's say for the sake of argument, a cladding panel, and they see, you know, on the manufacturer's website, they see that little triangular logo of BBA. That's very reassuring for a start.
Absolutely.
You see that, and then you can go and you can download the BBA certificate, and then you've got a bit of paper that you can print out with lots of facts and figures and descriptions and lots of reassuring comments saying this is a conforming product.
I asked my man that. I said, you know, isn't that all reassuring to us? He says, I bet you there's not a single QS has ever got past page one of our paperwork.
Well,
it's just, have you got the badge? Fine, great. Don't you see the small print?
Yeah.
Which is not necessarily the BBA's fault, I dare say, again. But I do think there's an issue with transparency at the BBA, which is why I very much hope that Heidi Giesler, the new chief executive, does agree to spend at least 20 minutes talking to me and saying that he recognises what the issues are and what he plans to do about it.
Yeah.
And in the wake of, we talked last week about the new building products regulator, that's a big issue. All the stuff that's come out from Grenfell Tower, it's not just cladding, it's all building products. And another interesting appointment, actually, just this month, the BBA have got a newly created post of technical director. They've appointed Bill Hewlett, who's been the technical director of Costain for the past 15 or 16 years or something. So Bill Hewlett is obviously a man fully on top of what contractors do, know, need to know, how they operate, what they want. And so from that side of things, so you've got a top man from the contracting world in at the top of the BBA and a top man from the building products world in at the top of the BBA. Yeah. It sounds to me like we've got two people running the show at the top of the show there who ought to be getting it sorted out, and I've got every confidence that they will, and I look forward to finding out more about it.
Phil, should we talk about tunnels?
Yay! Yes.
Nice to talk about something positive and interesting, very interesting. There's been quite an achievement.
Well, I know you want to talk about a new way of cheating at tunnelling, but we should probably just give a quick mention. Old-fashioned, Colditt-style tunnelling. This is in the papers this morning. apparently, somewhere around, what's the damn station? Euston Station in London.
Okay.
Related to HS2, the heirs to the crown of Swampy, who we've mentioned before, the Twyford Down Tunnel.
Oh, yes.
Some activists have been digging tunnels under where HS2 is supposed to be, HS2 work's supposed to be going on in order to stymie works there. So that's the old-fashioned way, and not terribly safe, and I don't recommend it.
Did nobody notice them vaulting over a wooden horse outside the station?
Shaking their trouser legs.
Yeah, exactly. Where have all those tablespoons gone? Yeah.
No, but if the HS2 protesters are watching, here's you won't be able to do this undetected, but a really, really good way to build a tunnel has been demonstrated by Morgan Sindland Network Rail near Peterborough. It's been going on for ages, but they reached the climax this week. Do you want to talk us through it, David? You've looked at the video, I'm sure.
Well, yeah, I have. It's a time-lapse video, which I think... Have you posted it on the website? I think you
it
have,
is.
Haven't you?
Yep.
Yeah, on the website. And it's astonishing, really. This is a concrete box, it weighs 11,000 tons, concrete box, which is obviously the body of a tunnel. So they haven't used a TBM to drive through here.
It's big enough to get two trains through. That's so big.
Yes, indeed. That's what it's for. Yeah, sorry, I should have said that. It's a concrete box. It's been pushed under the East Coast Main Line near Peterborough. They used, I think, four hydraulic jacks to push this massive thing underneath the railway, so as not to disrupt rail services. Of course, if you disrupt rail services, it can be very expensive, and you don't want to do it. And of course, a massive tunnel like this, it's, I can't remember how long it is,
155 metres,
and it's curved. That was a thing which really struck me. I mean, pushing something in a straight line with hydraulic jacks is one thing. Actually pushing it round a corner is something else altogether.
I was going to give 155 metres in old money. It's 1.5 football pitches.
Oh, is it? Well, it's a fair old distance. And they did it at a rate of 1.5 metres per hour. So it wasn't something, the sort of thing you do very quickly. It took 9 days. I don't know who the main contractor was. Morgan Sindel. I'm not sure who the consulting engineer on this job was. Do you know that, Phil?
Do you know, it's such a shame that, Network Rail and Highways England are two of those bodies that are pretty rubbish at crediting their suppliers.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm assuming that either Enerpac or Mammut were involved in there somewhere, since
yes.
they're big in this, but I don't know which one of them it was. They're not credited. So, no, I don't have the full team, and it's a shame. We should have, shouldn't we?
Mm. Well, whoever engineered it, obviously knows their onions. Oh, this happened at Werrington. I should have mentioned just north of Peterborough, which is where it actually happened. Yeah, quite. So, I mean, I've seen tunnel pushes like this before, but I'm not sure I've seen anything quite as big, and I certainly haven't seen one go around a corner before. So it has been hailed as a first. A first for UK engineering.
But they've been building it off-site. They've been casting the concrete. This concrete box has been cast away from its final destination for months, ages, as you'd expect. But it meant they didn't have to do all that work right by the live railway track.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because whenever you talk about rail engineering and rail construction at the moment, everything is so dominated by HS2 that it's easy to forget that there are other huge projects going on around the country in the rail sector. I mean, this project is part of a £1.2 billion East Coast upgrade. So, you know, that's a big job. And yet all this happened. I mean, I wasn't really aware that they were working up to this until I actually saw the story posted yesterday. The next stage, apparently, at Werrington anyway, involves work to install two new tracks inside the new tunnel. And then they've got to put in the signalling and all the rest of it, all those sort of clever systems.
I can't help wondering, though, if they'd known, had they only known that COVID-19 was going to come along and people wouldn't be travelling on trains so much, where they would have thought, oh, well, we don't need to build off-site, we can just cast in situ.
Well, yes, maybe, but I don't know. I mean, I would have thought the East Coast Main Line, being fairly arterial, has been operating fairly normally, hasn't it, over the last year? I'm not sure. I don't know. I mean, I can't remember the last time I went on a train, so I don't know what the services are like at the moment. But yes, I suppose there's a lot fewer people actually using the railways. But whether or not that means that they've reduced their services, I don't know. But it's incredibly expensive, isn't it, to disrupt a main route. You just don't want to do it.
It's one of those costs where I know there are relationships between Network Rail and the train franchise and the train operators and so on, and there are charges, that compensations that have to be paid. But yeah, like anything, when they talk about the cost of roadworks, of congestion, and if if a lorry delivering goods takes 60 minutes instead of 40 minutes, there mm-hmm. is a financial cost to that. But that's all, it's like weather forecasting. That's more art than science, it seems to me. So you could invent any number you liked saying what the cost of the disruption would be, I suppose. But in terms of pure construction cost and time comparisons, I would be interested to see the cost and time comparisons between this method of cast off site and push it in versus cast in situ. And it may well be that the cost difference aren't all that great.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, looking at the photograph on the website, you can see that certainly the first part of the tunnel is actually open. It's a cut and cover tunnel. I imagine it's just the bit which goes underneath the railway, the East Coast Main Line, which is the difficult bit, because obviously they couldn't cut that out. So a lot of it, I suppose, was fairly standard construction. You would have put down some piled retaining wall and then excavated it out, and then you can see some propping in there to keep the sides firm, and then they've just pushed this concrete box underneath it. So I don't know. They could have done a lot of it, I suppose, in a traditional way. But again, once you get to the railway line and you've got to go under it without disrupting it, then you need to think of something a bit cleverer than that, I suppose.
Well, it's the sort of thing we like, isn't it, Dave? Engineering innovations,
it is.
Right above
it
the street.
Is.
I mean, there's nothing that innovative about it. It's just a slightly, I'm going to have to say, thinking outside the box here, even though they're using a box, and I hate this phrase, thinking outside the box. But a little bit of sideways thinking. And hydraulic jacks aren't high tech or new or clever.
No.
All established, well-established technology, and just doing it something slightly different, which to my mind is even more interesting. It's why have we not done that before? We could have done this 30 years ago, this kind of method, I'm sure.
I'm sure we could. I'd really like to sort of dive down into some of the detail about how you go about doing something like this, because you've got an 11,000 ton concrete box. Obviously, that's going to take an awful lot of force to push it at a rate of 1500 millimeters per hour. Presumably, you need some sort of bearings or some sort of bed that it can slide across. I mean, how do you reduce friction on something like that? Because it's not on wheels. Presumably, you've got to have some sort of friction reducing surfaces, some bearing surfaces. And what do you brace the jacks against?
Why couldn't it be on wheels?
Oh, I suppose it could have been, but then you've got to actually build a prefabricated concrete box on wheels and then somehow remove the wheels. That means jacking it down again. No? Or do you mean just leave the wheels there?
Why not? They leave tower cranes inside buildings. They leave TBMs inside tunnels.
Well, that's true. Well, maybe we need Morgan Sindall to tell us how they did that and whether it was on wheels or it was on skids.
I suspect they like to keep something secret to themselves, don't they, for the next time? And fair play to them if they want to, I suppose. If you've developed a little bit of expertise, you're entitled to cash in on it.
My guess is that they laid down steel tracks and they used an awful lot of grease. And it was all nice and slippery and they just pushed it along the tracks. That's my guess. Anything else caught your attention this week? We discussed briefly, didn't we, over the phone, a story about the Green Homes Grant.
Yes.
Which I think ran in one of the national newspapers.
The Guardian had a very interesting piece yesterday. I haven't followed up on it. They've had a good conversation with various installers. But I would recommend anyone having a look at the Guardian website, since it's no paywall there, just like the Construction Index, free to access. And they've spoken to, I think there's three or four installers who are on the verge of going bust because the Green Homes Grant scheme is in utter chaos, as you and I kind of have been saying all along it was destined to be, which is a terrible shame, but hey, could have told you so. I hadn't realised it was an American firm doing the administration of it, and that's not helped, because they're not open in the daytime.
No, it seems like a developing theme here, because, of course, only today I've heard on the radio a lot of criticism of the COVID track and trace system. You know, we've reached that rather sobering 100,000 deaths milestone from COVID-19, and the privatised track and trace system is being held largely responsible for not really getting to grips with things. And it's very much like this situation here with the Green Homes Grant, which when it was first announced, I thought was excellent. It sounded like a really good idea. But there are people quoted in this article in The Guardian, companies who have actually done a lot of work purportedly underneath the Green Homes Grant and haven't been paid.
Yeah, and they've staffed up, trained up, got all geared up to do the work, done everything, jumped through all the right hoops, and then there's no money coming through.
So I think that's going to just disappear, that scheme. I don't think it can be revived. It seems to have failed from the start, actually.
Exactly the same as the last similar initiative, the green whatever that was that we had a couple of years ago.
But do you remember when it was first announced, we did, I think you and I both said, well, supposing I were to improve the energy efficiency of my home and do this, that, or the other. And we looked for local Trustmark registered suppliers. Yeah. And I can't remember what it was. I think it was wall insulation. If I wanted to put wall insulation in my home, I think the nearest one was in Leicestershire. And I live in North Devon. So
you'll be going up there for your jab in due course anyway, won't you? So you might as well pick it up.
That was a rather sobering story in The Guardian, and I think it came as no surprise to either you or I. I think we're going to see the back of the Green Homes Grant fairly shortly, and people will try not to mention it in polite society.
Well, it's got another year to run, theoretically, but they've failed, I'm afraid.
Yeah, I think so.
They being our lords and masters in government.
And on that bombshell, Phil.
Well, But do you realise, David, that today marks the first anniversary of Reconstruction, our podcast? We did our first one.
Really?
It's actually slightly over because it wasn't Wednesday, but we did our first one on Wednesday the 23rd of January, and it's now Wednesday the 27th of January. So we've been doing this a year.
Feels like a lifetime.
But it's I've been enjoying it, and I hope our listeners have been enjoying it too. And if you're still listening, drop us a line, please, at podcast@theconstructionindex. Tell us what you're talking about and thinking about. Tell us what we should be talking about and what we should be thinking about. You never know. We might even change our thinking.
Indeed.
From David and I, thank you very much for listening. Goodbye.
Goodbye.
Thank you for listening to Reconstruction, the podcast from the Construction Index. To keep up to date with the latest construction news and headlines, please visit theconstructionindex.co.uk and sign up for our free daily email news briefing.